This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Flame in the Dark, Soulwood Book 3, written by Faith Hunter, performed by Christine Vam.
Chapter 1. I walked the length of Turtle Point Lane near Jones Cove, my tactical flash illuminating the street and the ditch, trying to keep my eyes off the lawn and runnel of water and mature trees to the side. I should be in the trees, not here in the street, wasting my gifts on asphalt. I hated asphalt. To my touch, it was cold and dead, and it stank of tar and gasoline. But the canine teams had dibs on the grass and were already in the backyard. The mundane tracker dog and the paranormal tracker dog, with their handlers, and lights so bright they hurt my eyes when I looked that way. As a paranormal investigator, I had to wait until the human and canine investigators were finished, so my scent didn't confuse the paracanines. Standard operating procedure and forensic protocol. But that didn't mean I had to like it. Armed Special Weapons and Tactics Team, SWAT, officers, on loan from the city, patrolled the boundaries of the grounds, dressed in tactical gear and toting automatic rifles. Knoxville's Rural Metro Fire Department patrolled inside the house along with uniformed cops, suited detectives, and federal and state agents in this multi-agency emergency investigation. The SILED SAC, Special Agent in Charge of Unit 18, and my boss, had put me to work on menial stuff to keep me off the grass and out of the way until the dogs were completely done. As a probationary agent, I did what I was told, most of the time. My steps were slow and deliberate, my eyes taking in everything. Crushed cigarette butts stained by yesterday's rain, soggy leaves, broken auto safety glass and tiny pellets, flattened aluminum cans in the brush, and a depression, an energy drink, and a light beer, a gum box. Nothing new from the last 24 hours. I was surprised at the amount of detritus on a street with such upmarket houses. Maybe the county had no street sweeper machine, or maybe the worst of the filth ended up hidden in the weeds, hard to see, making the street appear cleaner than it really was. Life was like that, too, with lots of secrets hidden from sight. I had already searched the entire street with the Psi-meter 2.0 and put the bulky device in the truck. There were no odd levels of paranormal energies anywhere, a small spike on level 4 at the edge of the drive, but it went away, an anomaly. The Psi-meter 2.0 measured 4 different kinds of paranormal energies, called psisotopes, and the patterns could indicate a were-creature, a witch, an arc-en-ciel, and even a Welsh Gwili, shape-shifting devil dogs. I had nothing yet, but I needed onto the lawn to do a proper reading. I'd get my wish, eventually. I searched the area around Alexis, then a short row of BMWs. I took photos of each vehicle plate and sent them to JoJo, Unit 18's second-in-command and best IT person, to cross-check the plate numbers with the guest list. The air was frigid, and I was frozen, even though I was wearing long underwear, flannel-lined slacks, layered T-shirts, a heavy jacket, wool socks, and field boots. But then, along with uniformed county officers, I'd been at the ground search for 2 hours since the midnight call yanked me out of my nice warm bed and onto the job at a SILED crime scene. Field examination was scut work, the bane of all probie special agents, and we had found nothing on the street or driveway that might relate to the crime at the uber-fancy house on a cove of the Tennessee River. To make me more miserable, because I had drunk down a half gallon of strong coffee, I had to use the ladies, pretty desperately. I stared at the Holloway's house, trying to figure out what to do. "I just went to the back door and knocked," a voice said. I whirled. I'd been so intent that I hadn't heard her walk up. A young female sheriff's deputy grinned at me. Sorry, didn't mean to startle you, she said. Oh, it's okay. But it wasn't. I was jumpy and ill at ease for reasons I didn't understand. There were woods with fairly mature trees all around, water in the cove nearby, and well-maintained lawns the length of the street, all full of life that should have made me feel at home. Instead, I was jumpy. All that coffee, maybe. I'm Nell, Special Agent Ingram. I put out my hand and the woman shook it, businesslike. You don't remember me, she said, but we met at the hospital during the outbreak of the slime molds back a few weeks. You gave me your keys and let my partner and me get unis out of your vehicle. I never got the chance to thank you. Marie Holler and my partner, Chris Skeeter. She pointed to a taller, skinny man up the road. Your mother escaped from God's Cloud of Glory Church. Like I did, I said, referring to the polygamous church I grew up in. I remember. Her name was Carla, right? Marie grinned at me, seeming happy that I remembered. That's my mama, hard as nails and twice as strong. She indicated the dark all around. Us females always get it the worst on these jobs. The male deputies can just go in the woods, but it isn't so easy for women. The caterer let me in to use the bathroom, even gave me a pastry. Marie was short and sturdy with a freckled face, brown hair, and wearing her uniform tight, showing off curves. She had a self-assuredness I would never achieve. Her hair was cropped short for safety in close combat situations, but her lips were full and scarlet in the reflected glare from my flash, and she was fully made up with mascara and blush, even at the ungodly hour. Go on, and if they offer you something to eat, bring me another one of those pink-assed squares. I missed supper. I will. Thanks, I said. If I couldn't get her one, I'd give her a snack from my truck when I came back out, presuming the bread wasn't frozen. Still moving my flash back and forth, covering my square yard with each pass, I walked from the street up the drive into the back door, where I snapped off the light. I thought about knocking, but I had learned it was easier to apologize than to get permission. Not a lesson I had learned at the church where I was raised, but one I had learned since coming to work with Silad. I might get fussed at or written up, but no one would punish me for an infraction, like the churchmen did to the churchwomen. Opening the door, I slid the flash into its sheath and stepped inside. The warmth and the smell of coffee hit me like a fist. I unbuttoned my jacket so my badge would show and blinked into the warmth. My frozen face felt as if it might melt and slide off onto the marble tile floor. I breathed for a few moments and tried to unclench my fingers. My skin ached. My teeth hurt. The Arctic front had no regard for global warming. It had hit, decided it liked Tennessee Valley, and decided to stay. This was the second week of frigid temps. Snow, I liked. This? Not at all. Once the worst of the personal melting was done, I looked around. The kitchen was empty, a room constructed of stone in various shades of gray on the floor, and the cabinet tops at the backsplash. The owners must have taken down a whole mountain to get this much polished rock. The ceiling was vaulted with whitish wooden rafters and joists. Cabinets with the same kind of treated whitish wood rose 10 feet high. A ladder that slid on a bronze rail was in the corner. The stove was gas with 10 burners and a copper faucet over the stove tops, which looked handy, unless one had a grease fire and thought to use water to put it out. There was a commercial-sized coffee maker with a huge pot half full, 2 big double-glass door refrigerators, and a separate massive 2-door freezer. I spotted the small powder room off the kitchen and raced into it before anyone could come in and tell me to get outside and use the trees. I was one of maybe 25 law enforcement officers and investigators from the various law enforcement branches and agencies called in to the shooting at the Holloway home. The FBI was here to rule out terrorism because a U.S. senator, had been at the private political fundraiser when the shooting started. Silet, the Psychometry Law Enforcement Division of Homeland Security, was here because a vampire had been on site, too. The fire department was here because there had been a small fire. The local sheriffs, LEOs, were here because it was their jurisdiction. Crime scene investigators were here because there were three dead bodies on the premises. Though not the senator. He was shaken up, but fine. The ground search was because the shooter had come and gone on foot. It was complicated. The dead and wounded VIPs meant a lot of police presence and a shooting to solve, especially since the shooter got away clean. When I came back out, the kitchen was still empty, and I decided a bit more of the ask permission later was called for. Most anything was better than going back outside to search the road and paved areas for clues into a crime I had not been informed about. Two automatic dishwashers were running softly. The pastries were taped under waxed paper, including little pink iced squares. Marie would be disappointed. There were four ovens, and all but one was still warm to the touch. I inspected the planters under the windows. At first glance, they appeared to be full of herbs, basil, rosemary, thyme, and lemongrass. But the leaves were silk, which was weird in a kitchen that looked as if someone loved to cook. Trying to look as if I belonged, I wandered through a butler's pantry, complete with coffee bar, wet bar with dozens of decanters and bottles, and wine in a floor-to-ceiling special refrigerator. Beyond the butler's pantry, stairs went up on one side and down on the other, proving that the house had multiple levels, not just the two obvious from the outside. Picking up on the smell of smoke and scorched furnishings was easy here. I stayed on the main level and meandered into a formal dining room on one side of the entry. There was more stone here, too, and wood in the vaulted ceilings. The 12-foot-long dining table was set for a party, though I didn't recognize any of the food except the whole salmon and the tenderloin of beef. It seemed a shame to let the food go to waste when Marie was hungry. But there was blood on the floor in the doorway, leading from the back of the house to here. Since there was blood, the food itself might be evidence. So I kept my hands to myself and stepped carefully. I had seen EMS units racing away as I drove up, so I knew there had been casualties. But seeing blood was unsettling. My gift rose up inside me, as if it was curious. Not trying to drink the blood down, not yet, because I wasn't outside, my hands buried in the earth, but more like a mouse or cat who sees movement and crouches, trying to decide if this is something worth hunting. A formal living room decorated with a Christmas tree and presents and fake electric candles in the windows was on the other side of the entry. It had real wood floors and a 10-foot ceiling, with one of those frame things set in the middle to give it even more height, maybe called a tray ceiling, I wasn't sure. Life in the church hadn't prepared me with a good grasp of architectural terminology. The entire room felt stiff and uncomfortable to me, maybe due to the fact that all the plants were fake. Fancy tables, tassels on heavy drapes, carved lamps, furniture that looked showroom fresh. This wasn't a place to kick up your feet. The room was full of people in fancy dress, and oddly, I knew two of them. Ming of Glass, the vampire master of the city, and her bodyguard, a vamp I knew only as Yummy. Yummy flashed me a grin, one without fangs, which was nice, but she mouthed opossum at me, which was a tease I didn't really need. I mouthed back, ha-ha, not. Yummy laughed. All but three of the partygoers in the room looked irritated, two vamps and a human. Vamps tended to expressionless faces, unless they were irritated or hungry, both of which were a sign of danger. The human was sitting on an ottoman, and he looked devastated, face pale, his tie undone, a crystal glass in one hand, dangling between his knees. I figured he was the husband of one of the dead. There was blood spatter on his shirt and dark suit coat. A man who didn't belong in the expensively dressed crowd stood beside him, taking notes. A Fed, I figured as I slipped away, before I got caught, to wander some more. I passed uniformed and suited LEOs here and there, two I recognized as local, and one unknown wearing a far better fitting suit, probably another Fed. The firefighters left through the front door, big boots clomping, and gathered on the street. Two crime scene techs raced into the room off to the side carrying gear. No one paid any attention to me except to note that I had a badge on a lanyard around my neck. I hooked my thumbs into my pockets and moseyed over, probably a failure at looking as if I belonged. The action was in the game room, and the stench of fire grew heavier. Inside was a pool table, comfy reclining sofas, and a TV screen so big it took up most of the wall over the fireplace. On the opposite wall were antique guns and frames behind glass. Cast metal that might have been machine parts was protected within smaller frames. What looked like an ordinary wrench was centered on the wall in a heavy carved frame as if it was the most important thing hanging there. People commemorated the strangest things. There were also lots of old black and white photographs of stiff-looking people wearing stiff-looking clothes. Their hats and the way the women's clothes fitted said they were rich and pampered. The men's mustaches and thick facial hair made them look imposing, at least to themselves. They had that self-satisfied look about them, the expression of a hunter when he was posing with a 16-point buck. However, their expressions also made them look like their teeth hurt. Dental care was probably not very common back whenever these were taken. Standing in the doorway, I spotted Rick LaFleur, the special agent in charge of Unit 18, talking to Sol, his upline boss, the newly appointed assistant director, and another woman. If body language was a clue, the Psi-led agents were arguing with the African-American woman in the chic outfit. She wore the tailored clothes as if they were part of her, as much as the scowl and the aura of power. I figured she was the new VIP in charge of the Knoxville FBI. They were too busy to pay attention to me, so I strolled in, saw things, smelled things, touched things with the back of my hand here and there. The gas logs had been on, but were now only warm to the touch. A game of pool had been interrupted, and balls were all over the tabletop. The solids were mostly gone. One cue stick lay on the floor, in two pieces. Drinks of the alcoholic variety were on every available surface. The entire room smelled of fire, the sour scent of a house fire, painted wallboard and burned construction materials, lots of synthetics. The stench was tainted with what might have been the reek of scorched flesh. Icy night air blew in through the busted windows. Blackened draperies billowed. Charred furniture and rugs spread into the room from the window. The fire seemed to have started there. There were bullet holes on the wall opposite the windows, and there was a pool of blood on the floor. A body lay in the middle of it. She had taken a chest shot, dead instantly if I was any kind of judge. There was no taped outline, no chalk outline. Just the blood and the body still in place. I stared at her. The victim was middle-aged with dyed blonde hair and blue contacts drying and wrinkling, shrinking over her gray eyes. She was wearing a pale blue sweater top and black pants, 3-inch black spike shoes. Diamonds. Lots of them. There was blood spatter on the wall in an odd outline, as if someone had been standing behind her. Blood on a chair and small table. Blood on a shattered glass on the mantel near her. That bloody pool beneath her was tracked through by the shoe prints of the people who had tried to save her. There was a lot of blood. my gift of reading the land and feeding the land with blood, was less reticent now, more focused, hungering. But I'd been working with it, trying to harness it. And I stroked the need like the hunting cat I compared it to, flattening its surface, pushing it into stillness. Proud of myself that I had the strength of will to not feed my hunger and the earth beneath the house, I turned from the body. By now, the crime scene had been captured in photos and video and cell cameras and drawn out on paper by hand. Multiple redundancies. Crime scene techs were still working, but oddly there were no numbered evidence markers in the room. I had to wonder why. Maybe they had been placed there, then already removed as CSI gathered up the physical evidence. I approached the broken windows. Outside, a coroner's unit waited, lights not flashing, not in an upscale neighborhood. The EMTs and their vehicles had left with the wounded. Three, I had heard, one critical. Farther beyond, a media van waited, a camera on a tripod and a reporter in front of it, filming for the morning news. In the dark of the driveway, where the cameras couldn't get a shot, two uniformed figures lifted a gurney with a body bag into the coroner's van. There was already one gurney inside. Three dead, three wounded at this scene. The window glass was shattered in pellets all over the floor. It reminded me of the automobile glass outside, but this was clear and the vehicle glass had been tinted and well ground into the asphalt. The cloth blinds were burned and tattered, the drapery seared. The walls were scorched all around them and up to the ceiling. A table by the window was mostly shattered charcoal and candles had melted across the surface. A blackened glass was on its side. It looked as if the shots had smashed the glass, spilling the alcohol and toppling the lit candle. I guessed that the fire had spread quickly. But I wasn't a fire and arson investigator. I knew to keep my opinions to myself unless asked. Opinions went into the evidentiary summary report in the opinion box, where they were mostly ignored. They weren't facts. I slipped out before someone asked me what I was doing. Next door was the master bedroom. Master suite. Yes, that sounded right. It was full of people. Instead of pushing my luck, I slowly went up the staircase onto the second level. On the second floor were six bedrooms and four full baths, counting the servants' powder room, the ensuite in the master, and the two guest powder rooms on the ground floor. That was a lot of bathrooms. I'd grown up in a house that technically had more square footage and more bedrooms than this one, but it was nowhere near as fancy. The Holloway's home was luxurious, what T. Lane probably called new money decadent. They probably paid their decorator more than the yearly income of most American families. I traipsed back down, hearing T. Lane's and Tandy's voices from the master suite. T. Lane was Tammy Lane Kent, Psi-Led Unit 18's moon witch, one with strong earth element affinities, and enough unfinished university degrees to satisfy the most OCD person on the planet. That was how she had introduced herself to me. Tandy was the unit's empath, who claimed his superpower was being struck by lightning. I'd wandered around as much as I could without entering the master suite, but I was nosy. So I stood just outside that door, taking the excuse to see, hear, and learn what I could before being banished back into the cold by Rick, who was now standing in said master suite. He was in front of the window, facing the door and me, being dressed down by a well-suited FBI agent type in an expensive suit and tie, regulation all the way. Rick's black hair was too long to be regulation, and his black eyes were tired, and his olive skin looked sallow. Rick had aged in the last weeks, though he looked a bit better now that he had learned how to shift into his black were-leopard form and back to human. He frowned at me, but didn't interrupt his conversation. "This isn't one of your magic wand and broomstick investigations," the Fed said. It was said in the tone of an older kid to a young one, insult in each syllable, in a local towny accent. This was an attack on a house party and fundraiser with some of the biggest movers and shakers in Tennessee. Super wealthy business and political types with their fingers in every financial pie in the nation. Toneless, Rick said. With all due respect, there were witches and vampires at the party. The strike could have been aimed at the Tennessee Senator, Abrams Tolliver, as you assume, or at Ming. The closest thing Knoxville has to a vampire master of the city, with whom he was speaking. I knew of the Tollivers, rich, powerful people, who made their money when the Tennessee Valley Authority stole the land of all the state's farmers and changed the face of the South. The men of God's Cloud preached about the entire Tolliver family going to hell and maybe taking up their own special circle right next to the devil himself. Or just the fully human victim, or one of the human homeowners, which is far more likely. This is not your case, the suit said. This is a joint FBI-ATF and Secret Service investigation, not some trivial magic case. You are incorrect, Sol said. I stepped quickly to the side, because the assistant director of SILED was standing behind me and I was blocking the door. My heart started beating too fast, and my bloodlust rose with my reaction. I pushed down on it, anxious about its agitation, but not worried enough to leave the house. You need to return to the living room with the other guests, lady, the suit said. He sounded frustrated and unimpressed at the vision Sol presented. All gauzy fabrics, platinum hair and curves. On the contrary, I am exactly where I belong, young man. Who the hell are you? If you're law enforcement, where's your badge and ID? He replied. The room fell silent. I covered my mouth and moved inside quickly, along the wall, to keep them all in view. Sol walked slowly closer to him, silvery gauze waving in a rising wind that wasn't really there. I didn't have the same kind of magic as Sol, but I felt her power on my skin like small sparks of electricity. Our concierge magic was wild and hot, a shape-shifting ability that defied the laws of physics as scientists understood them. It wasn't common knowledge. In fact, half of Unit 18 didn't know that Sol was a rainbow dragon. A creature made of light. But even without that knowledge, if the suit didn't know a stalking predator when he saw one, then he needed to spend some more time in the wild to hone his survival instincts. What did you say? Sol asked. Hamilton, a woman barked. What the bloody hell? It was the woman from the game room, the African-American woman who wore the power of her office like a crown and robe. Her ID was clipped at her collar, and her name was E.M. Schultz. Sol didn't turn to her, keeping her eyes on the suit and saying, I've been on a conference call to Silent Director Clarence Lester Woods, the Secretary of Homeland Security, and the Director of the FBI. As well as the head of alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. This is a joint investigation between four, not three, branches of law enforcement. You may address me as Assistant Director Siled, and your services are no longer needed at this crime scene. She turned her head as if looking for something. In a tone that wasn't quite a question, not quite a demand, she said, Special Agent Ingram. I jumped. Sol kept on talking. Take Mr. Hamilton outside. Give him your flashlight. Teach him how to do a perimeter ground search. Then come back in here. I need your services. I was staring at Hamilton, his name touching down in my mind, in the place designated for it. Chadworth Sanders Hamilton, his father's second son from his second wife, named for his mother's grandfathers, and my third cousin, by way of Maud Nicholson, my grandmother, my distant cousin from the towny side of the family. I'd heard he had graduated from the FBI Academy at the top of his class and come back home to make his mark. This embarrassing dressing down was likely not the mark he wanted to make. I held up a hand to identify myself and silently led the way to the kitchen. There I found foam cups, poured coffee from the coffee maker, and put them on a tray with napkins, a bread knife, and a spoon. I could practically feel the embarrassment and fury emanating off Hamilton as I worked, my back to him. At least the anger would keep him warm for a while, and there was no way I was going to tell him that we were related when he was so furious. Maybe later. Maybe. Carefully, tray balanced, I left the warmth of the house, my cousin on my heels, not offering to help with the load. I didn't know if that made him a jerk or just oblivious, but so far my cousin was not making a very good impression. Outside, I flashed my light 3 times, handed it to Hamilton, and said, 4,800 lumens. Battery will last another 2 hours before it has to be recharged. 1 yard squares, from the middle of the ditch to the middle of the lane. This will be the 3rd pass, so it should be pretty clean. What's up, Ingram? Mayrie asked, joining us at a jog. The other deputies followed, and so did 3 SWAT officers, until we had a small crowd. Coffee, I said, unnecessarily, as they reached in for the cups. Keys. I placed them in Mayrie's hand. There's a loaf of bread in the passenger seat of my truck and a jar of jam. Bring the knife and spoon back when you're all done. I'll get some fresh coffee out here as soon as I can. Mayrie dashed down the road to my car. I continued to the others. This is Hamilton, Proby. Looks like he came out without a coat, so he'll be cold. It's all right, kid, a deputy said. The county cop was 6'6", easy, and had a chest like a whiskey barrel. We've all been stupid from time to time. Several officers laughed. Hamilton flinched and burned hotter, probably thinking about the dressing down he'd just received, not the coat he'd forgotten. Probably furious that he'd been called kid by a county cop. Someone an FBI officer might look down on, in the hierarchy of law enforcement types, but he kept his mouth shut. He looked pale in all the flashlights and totally out of place, underdressed in his fancy suit. The deputy continued, I got an extra jacket in my unit. It'll hang to your knees, little fella like you, but it's clean. Hang on, I'll get it. He too jogged off. I didn't laugh at my cousin's expression at the words, little fella like you. Hamilton accepted a cup of coffee, and the coat, and a slice of bread and jam. I waited until the cups were gone and Hamilton was wearing the borrowed coat and starting on the road. He was all but kicking the pavement like a kid. I hadn't told him who I was, that we were distant cousins. My grandma Maud had been disowned when she married into the church, and I doubted that Hamilton knew I existed. Back inside, I figured out how to work the coffee machine and got coffee gurgling, found a gallon-sized carafe, a tablecloth, more napkins, and foam cups. When the coffee was ready, I took the tray back outside, placed the tablecloth on the hood of a county car, the tray on top it, and went back inside where I made another trip to the powder room and put on fresh lipstick. The assistant director of Psylid wanted me for something. That made me nervous. I had learned that lipstick gave me false courage. False was better than no courage at all. I made my way through the house until I found Rick, Soul, and a seated man in khakis and a golf shirt in a small room on the 2nd floor. The room was no bigger than a closet, a tiny space dedicated to the Holloway security system, 2 vacuum cleaners, brooms, push mops of various designs, and lots of cleaning supplies. I slipped in behind Rick and leaned against the wall so I could watch the security video beside his shoulder. It was a nice system. I had studied most commercial brands and a couple dozen government kinds while in spook school, the Psylid training facility. This was an integrated one, with motion detection sensors that triggered the outside cameras and automatically downloaded all video to the system. Later, someone had to go through all the captured images and delete the homeowner's dogs, wildlife, and the occasional teenagers sneaking into or out of the house after hours. Currently, there were 4 images on the big screen. "There are 4 cameras with views of the outside," the khaki-clad man said. "But there's no sign of the shooter's approach to the house until here." He stopped on the video and pointed to the image on top. "He or she seems to be able to bypass all the cameras until he stops, where he, for convenience we'll say he, appears as a vague shape outside the windows of the game room." The shape was little more than a smear of movement, not really visible on digital, as if he somehow disrupted and blurred the images. Magic could do that. So could some types of disruptor equipment the military was working on in R&D. However, by the blurred images, it appeared as if it was a lone assassin. The image on the screen started moving again. "Exactly 8 seconds after he appeared on screen, he started shooting. And unlike the man, or woman, wielding it, the weapon is easily visible as a fully automatic M4 carbine." The video progressed to show the attacker shooting. "M4? Sol asked. "How did he get an M4?
"Don't know, ma'am," Khaki Man said. "The M4 carbine is heavily used by 2 branches of United States Armed Forces as the primary infantry weapon. It's currently available on the open market. And it's legal in Tennessee. So it isn't impossible to get one."
I dredged through the day of class we spent on military weapons and remembered that the M4 was replacing the M16 rifle in most Army and Marine Corps combat units. So, except for the way the shots were fired, the attacker could be military, or the weapon could be stolen, or purchased on the commercial market. He could have gone in most anywhere. "All right," Sol said. Playing the footage again, Khaki Man said,
"There were 4 3-second bursts, moving from the shooter's left to his right, combined with 1 extended magazine change, which takes place here."
He stopped the security video with each statement and pointed as the shooter changed out magazines.
"Then he started shooting again and repeated the 4 3 bursts. Then he took off."
To me, the attacker's motions, though blurred, looked masculine.
"One thing of note, shooting through glass is tricky. Well-trained shooters usually put a single shot through the glass first, then take out the targets. Inside," he continued, "the female falls. 2 other victims fall, here and here."
He pointed again. Though the images were badly blurred, the outdoor camera picking up little inside.
"People take cover. Rounds topple the candles, which ignite tablecloths. Fire leaps to the draperies, races over the furniture and up the walls, then follows the oxygen outside through the broken windows."
He showed us footage of the fire blazing out through the broken window.
"Then the shooter is tackled by a security guard, Amos Gerling. Amos said he could see the gun, but not the person. You can see here the flash of flame when Amos was burned. Deep second or maybe 3rd degree on his upper arm and left hand, with visible and significant muscle damage. Source of the flame is unknown at this time, though ATF and the fire department are checking for accelerants on Amos's clothing. Assassin then seems to disappear into thin air. Our security people put out the fires, inside and out, with extinguishers, and began emergency medical treatment on the victims."
"What branch?" Sol asked.
"Beg pardon, ma'am?"
"What branch did you serve in? All the men and women who work for ALT Security Services are former military."
"I see you do your homework, ma'am."
Khaki Man spun in his chair. He was tanned brown, the color of a hickory nut in fall, with close-cropped dark hair and greenish eyes. The name tag said his name was P. Simon.
"Green Beret, ma'am. 4 active tours in the Middle East."
"Where and when?"
"Classified, ma'am."
"Of course." but I could tell by her tone that Sol would find out in case the man was involved with the shooter on the wrong side. If this shooting was an inside job, the security team would be the first suspects.
"Can you tell me what the dogs found, ma'am?"
Simon asked.
"No," Rick said. "Sorry, need to know."
Sol glanced at Rick before speaking. "The canine unit's findings will be released to the press shortly. I think we can divulge this now. The standard crime scene canine dog was able to track a suspect across the back lawns, across the tip of the cove to Lion's Bend Road, where the trail disappeared. We have officers going door to door to see if a vehicle is missing, or if an unfamiliar vehicle was seen parked somewhere. The paranormal canine dog gave scent signs only for human scent, giving no sign for non-human species. The paranormal dogs were trained only to know paranormal types, so Sol wasn't giving much away. She went on. Despite the shooter's disappearing act, there is no indication of magic used at the scene of the crime, nor at the scene of the perpetrator's appearance and disappearance. He used a mundane military weapon, and he sensed human. Simon said,
"It's obvious by the camera distortion that he used some kind of obfuscation spell over himself. Therefore, not human, ma'am,"
he added, proving that whatever classified jobs he'd had in the military, he knew how some magic affected digital tech. Obfuscation spells were fairly new, having been around only 3 years or so.
"And that places this under our jurisdiction,"
Rick murmured. "Discussion is taking place at high levels about who will take lead on this case," Sol said, her voice calm. By discussion, I knew she meant arguments. Every branch of law enforcement wanted this case except the sheriff, who had too much political acumen to want anything to do with a United States senator, 3 rich dead VIPs, multiple wounded, and vampires.
"Ingram," Sol said.
I jerked upright, away from the wall where I had slouched, and said,
"Yes, ma'am."
It was time for whatever job Sol had for me. Her eyes flashed darkly in her olive-skinned face, and she smoothed her platinum hair, twisting it in its long, curling coil.
"K-9 is finished. CSI has completed their outdoor work. Walk the grounds. Sit for a while. Look things over. Tell me what you find."
"Yes'm." I turned and hightailed it out of the security cave and outside. I was being told to use my gift, to read the land. As I fled the house, my gift crouched and licked its lips, metaphorically speaking, not in reality. Or that was what I told myself. I buttoned my jacket as I walked to the truck again, getting out the Psi-meter 2.0 and my faded pink blanket, and then back to the window where the shooter had stood. Turning, I viewed the grounds and the drive and the darker smear of the cove. The air smelled icy and rivery, that peculiar odor of the Tennessee River at normal levels, and my nose felt frozen. My breath was a white cloud in the security lights. Somewhere nearby, an owl hooted. Farther off, a dog barked, distressed. The canine dogs and handlers were gone. SWAT was gone. The coroner's vehicle pulled away with the woman's body as I watched. The lights illuminating the backyard went out, which made me smile. Rick, or maybe Sol, was making sure no one could see me when I went to work. I saw Hamilton walking back from the street up the drive, my flashlight still brightening his way. He didn't see me, and went on inside. 3 sheriff deputies' cars pulled away, 2 couples and a group of 5 guests left, walking down the road for the cars parked along the verge. 3 of the BMWs left, too. Overhead, the sky was still black, but it wouldn't be long until it shifted into the gray pre-dawn. I closed my eyes, letting my night vision return. I breathed the air and let my body relax. It was easier to read the land when I wasn't hyped up. That was JoJo's term for excited and nervous. Hyped up. I set the folded blanket on the grass and calibrated the Psi-meter 2.0. I did a quick scan of the area under the window and then across the yard, getting only small cisotope spikes on level 4. Nothing definitive. Not even anything I could point to and say maybe. And when I checked a second time, they seemed to be fading, reading slightly lower on the scale than before. Anomalies? I wouldn't be determining the species of creature just now, but that couldn't be helped. I turned off the unit and sat on the blanket. Blowing out of breath, I placed my hands down, palms open on the lawn and pressed down. Scratched my fingertips into the thick grass until I touched the dirt below. Instantly, the discomfort I had been feeling all night eased. This was where I belonged. I breathed for a few minutes, letting my body settle and my gift quest free. Down, into the earth. With a job to do and earth to read, my bloodlust settled too. Grass leaves, crisp and dormant, the roots thick, well-fed and satisfied, was the first thing I read. It had been grown as sod and placed atop soil that had been enriched with mushroom compost and a good mix of supplements. Roots of trees, shrubs, and plantings intertwined. Insects and grubs and earthworms were hibernating. Down into the ground I quested, deeper. Rocks were here, the rounded stones of a much larger river bottom. Limestone below that, holy and shattered. The first water table was only a few yards deep. I pulled back and let my interest settle on the grass. Plants didn't tend to notice things outside of rain, abundance or lack of nutrients, abundance or lack of sunlight, fire, seasons, and the phases of the moon. So I didn't expect to sense anything, but I did. I found a path of damage. It trailed from the trees near the cove to the window and back. Both paths crossed a runnel that fed the water in the cove. The path of wounded plants extended beyond that, all the way to the asphalt. I rechecked with the psi meter 2.0, which showed next to nothing, now. The shooter had left a trail, one only I could follow. Chapter 2. The grass was dying, its leaves injured, the roots failing. The shooter had damaged them all. By next week, the path it took would be brown and dead. There was no way that the shooter was human. But I had no idea what it was, and that was the first thing that Rick and Sol would want to know. If I could identify the type of paranormal creature it was, that might place the entire investigation into the hands of the Psi-led team. Without that, no federal agency would consider relinquishing control. I stood and carried the Psi-meter back to the truck, where I locked it in, and then took my blanket into the darkness, toward the trees, following the trail of the whatever it was. Every place where its feet touched down was dead. To the side, spreading out, was less damage, but I didn't think that grass would survive either. It was a type of injury I could follow even without having my hands in it, yet the dormant grass didn't even know it had died, as if passing away in its sleep. I walked through the yard, my fingers freezing, my toes frozen, my cheeks felt even colder, and I realized that I was crying, crying for the death in the ground. I reached the trees at the back of the property and moved deeper into them, into the darkness. The roots along the shooter's pathway were wounded, but I thought the trees would survive, all but one little scrub oak. It was maybe 5 feet tall, only a few spindly branches to either side, and it was nearly dead. I spread my blanket out and sat next to the oak. I cupped my hands around the base of the tree so that the outer pads of my hands touched the ground, my fingers on the bark. Sinking into the tree, I felt along the pathways up and down it, the starchy sugars and oils and organic molecules that spoke of life. The ruined limbs were at the outer edges where the thing had brushed by it, touching it with the death in its body. I could trim them back, but it wouldn't help. The roots were damaged in ways I couldn't even understand. I tried pushing life into them, tried to heal the small tree. But it was ruined. It was dead. I sat back on my backside. I understood why people cut down healthy trees. I understood the concept of trees as crops and building materials, of trees being removed for habitations and business buildings. But killing for the sake of killing, even trees, was an alien concept to me. And this creature, the shooter, was a killer. A killer by nature, perhaps? A killer by its cellular composition? It appeared that it killed just as it breathed, by body chemistry or by instinct, by predisposition and reflex. I knew it, but I couldn't prove it. I didn't know what the shooter was, but the death of the tree made me weep. I wiped my cheeks, feeling the chapped skin. I didn't question why I cried more over a baby tree than I did over the woman the shooter had killed. Surely the woman with the gray eyes deserved a greater grief. I would have to look at my own biases, but later, when I had time, after this long night was over. Wiping my face, I stood, gathered up my blanket, and continued after the killer. I followed the death of plants through the woods, ignoring the scratches of nearby limbs, the vines and shoots and roots set to trip me, reaching down to the roots trying to support them all, to the end of the cove where I stopped. The destruction led directly into the water. I thought about following the trail in, but a stupid image of a crocodile coming out of the water to chew me up stopped me. I knew there were no crocs or alligators this far north, but knowing wasn't believing. Instead, I walked to the end of the cove and down the other side about 20 feet. He had probably tried to throw off tracker dogs, but good dogs didn't get fooled so easily. Neither did I. The dead earth was simple to spot, easy as pie. I picked up the trail and followed it out of the neighborhood. By the time I stumbled out onto the main road, I was exhausted. I'd given too much of myself to the land and to the dying sapling. I crossed the ditch and sat down hard, the frozen earth penetrating through my pants instantly. I shoved the blanket under me and huddled into my coat, hands in my pockets, where I discovered a pair of gloves I hadn't known I carried. That was stupid. My fingers were so cold they ached bone deep. I pulled the coat high on my neck and huddled down, searching for body warmth that seemed dangerously lacking. Down the road I saw bright lights coming my way, a car slowing. I was alone, on a country road before dawn. I should be afraid. I should open my coat and have my hand on my service weapon. But I was mad. And if anyone tried to hurt me right now, pulled over in a car and tried to abduct me, I'd drain them into the earth and feed the land and feed myself. And that thought was scary. When had I thought about replenishing my own energies with the life force of another? A dark pit opened up in me, full of dread dreams and fear. The car stopped and the door opened.
Nell?
It was Oakham. I blinked against the glare and squinted at him, and remembered him asking me to dinner only a few weeks or so ago. The dread and fear spread. We had never addressed that invitation. We had gone on as if he had never spoken, never asked. But I remembered. And I was apprehensive and fretful at what dinner with the were-leopard might mean.
You okay, Nell Sugar?
Not really. He started toward me and I barked, "Don't touch me!" Oakham stopped, backed slowly to the car and behind the door.
"Come on, get in the car. I'll take you back to the house. Rick should never have sent you out alone.
Why? Because I'm a woman?
I asked in my strongest church dialect, indignant. No, because this is a dangerous situation and we should be working in pairs.
I thought about that. If I'd had someone with me, would I have spent less of myself trying to save the sapling? Probably. I'd have been smarter because I'd have been thinking more about humans and not so much about trees.
Oakham stood by his car, letting me think. In a more towny accent, I asked,
"Where have you been all night?"
"In the office, off the master suite, questioning the partygoers,"
he said, his Texas accent stronger than usual, deliberately calming, soothing.
"Bunch of self-entitled snobs, useless in a firefight, two of them wet their britches."
A chuckle burst out of me. Dark cop humor, bloody and coarse. But it helped newbies to adjust, to view death and horror impersonally. My laughter faded away. Yes, I had needed a partner. The wearies pulling at my muscles like claws, I stood and dragged my blanket with me, trudging to the passenger door. I got in to find the heater blasting on full. I pulled my gloves back off and held my hands to the vents as Oakham's fancy car took us back to the house. I watched him as he parked in the drive, his blonde hair swinging, his amber eyes looking fully human. He glanced at me in a way, as if sensing my mood. Oakham said nothing, just got out of his fancy car, taking my blanket and putting it in my truck before he followed me inside the house, and went back to whatever he had been doing before he came to check on me. Standing in the cramped space of the security system, I made my report to Rick and Sol.
"Can you prove it wasn't human?" Sol asked.
"Empirical evidence in a few days," I said, speaking in my work accent. "Maybe, but not scientifically." Sol heaved a sigh she might really need. I wasn't sure if her species needed air the same way humans did. Maybe they breathed through their pores or had holes in their rib cages or something.
"I'd like you to speak with Ming of Glass and her bodyguard. See what you can get out of them. When you're done, they may leave with our thanks."
I stood, flat-footed, meeting Sol's gorgeous and slightly amused eyes. At her side, Rick looked as surprised as I felt.
Don't you think there might be someone better than me to talk to a vampire?"
"No," Sol said. "You are precisely the right person to address the issue of paranormal beings who've committed first-degree murder and or hate crimes with the highest-ranked vampire in Knoxville. And it will be an opportunity to rebuild bridges that you set fire to when you referred to all Mithrans as smelling maggoty, I believe."
I blushed hotly, and the last of the chill flushed out of my body.
"Oh, you think she knows?"
"I am quite certain that she knows. Your reaction to Mithrans has made all the rounds. Go make nice with the head of Clan Glass. Rebuild some bridges. She's waiting on you upstairs in the office we're using as an interrogation room. Go on," she added when I stood there. "Take Tandy with you."
I left the room, which had suddenly grown too close and lost all oxygen. Tandy was outside the door, his reddish-brown eyebrows lifted. Like Oakham, I hadn't seen him all night.
"You heard?" I asked. "That you're supposed to go with me to question the vampires?"
"No, but I felt." "What happened?"
Tandy was the unit's empath, which meant he could tell what other people were feeling, humans and paranormals both. The gift had been forced on him by Mother Nature when he was hit by lightning 3 times, and the reddish Lichtenberg lines that crossed his pale skin like the veins in leaves were a lasting legacy. I told him what had happened, and about my punishment, as we climbed the stairs to the 2nd floor. He didn't laugh, which was nice. He handed me a folder containing several printed papers, including the questions that had been asked of all the party guests and two floor plans of the crime scene room, one with X's for where everyone had been standing. A dozen more.